I want to start at the end of the story where you left the listeners, because at that point, Loser was in a kind of uncertain place. And I'm wondering if you know of any updates, where he is, does he have a job, is he making any money, is he still with the girlfriend?
He has a place, he has an apartment now, he has a full-time job. There's a an electronics sort of audio video store in New York called B&H that is famously staffed by Hasidic people. a friend of his got him a job there. So that's where he's working. A friend of his, actually, from the Hasidic world, one of the few people who emerged, actually, after I finished reporting the story and offered to sort of give him a hand, despite the fact that he was no longer religious, got him the job there. So he's doing much better. He still struggles with, I think, a lot of the issues that he talks about in the piece, but, you know, it's obviously become less intense. But he still, you know, he still has these, I was just communicating with him a few days ago, and, you know, he still slips into these depressions for a few days. And I think, you know, he's not always completely forthcoming about what happens in that, but, you know, I think it's related to the fact that, you know, he's completely disconnected from the life that he grew up in, from the culture he grew up in, and from his family, of course.
When he looks back on the world he came from, do you think that he sees it as something he misses, something he resents, something mm-hmm. that was too repressive, mm-hmm. You know, sort of intellectual slavery? I mean, that's putting it harshly, but I'm wondering how he sees it when he looks back.
All of the above. Everything you mentioned. You nailed it. And he talks a little bit about this in the piece. It's a really wonderful life. I mean, it's a very family-oriented, community-oriented life. Everybody looks out for each other, you know. There's a lot of warmth, and there's a lot of togetherness, and there's a lot of love in that, in a way. The problem for him is that the foundation of it, the guiding foundation and principle of everything that you do in your life, is this belief in God, and a belief in a very specific and strict and exhaustive set of rules and regulations that God supposedly commands you to obey. And so if your belief in God is shaky, you know, the whole thing falls apart. And there's just no room for that. You just can't feel that way there. It's just, you can't decide that you don't want to participate in some of these rituals. So it's very conflicted. I think, you know, you said intellectual slavery. I mean, I think Loser would put it in terms that harsh. I do think he feels like he was locked in a world that kept him very narrow-minded and very removed from ideas and from the world. And he's a very curious person, and he needed to explore that.
What was the tipping point for him? Do you know?
I do. This was a little bit cumbersome to get into in the piece, because there was sort of, it would have taken a fair amount of time to kind of to lay it all out, especially in a non-narrated piece. You know, he actually, to be honest, it was a slow process. He started sort of sneaking around and going to movies, or he bought like a DVD player, and he used to go and like park his car, like drive outside of the community and like park his car on the side of the road and watch DVDs. It's sort of, when he describes it, it's like, you know, it's this like very illicit sounding activity, which it was, you know, but to you and I, it might, you know, it wouldn't necessarily be that way, or we wouldn't think of it that way. But, and he was happy at the time for a while to live this kind of double life. And I met a number of people, while reporting this story, who do that and are happy to do that. They can enjoy the benefits of the life, the family, and the community and the culture that they know and that they care about, but they can also do the things that they want to do and experience the things they want to experience, the culture of the secular world. They can read books that are skeptical of religion and experience ideas that are not acceptable in that community. And that they're fine with that. And I think Loser would have been fine with that, maybe. It was ultimately his wife who said, "You're in or you're out. You know, this is not okay with me anymore." For a while, she indulged it. But so at that point, he had to make a choice, and he chose to leave.
So backing up a little bit, how did you come across his story, or how did you meet him? And what was the process like doing this documentary with him over a long time? How often did you record? Mm-hmm. That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I met him. I knew I wanted to do something around this subject. It just seemed, you know, that the potential for the human drama was so great. And living in New York, there are very large Hasidic communities here. So, you know, everybody is aware of them. And most people are, you know, like myself, extremely curious about them, you know, because it is this closed world and you don't really know what it's like. And it's hard to gain access to what it's like. I sort of made it up in my head. I didn't even know of people doing this, but I sort of made it up in my head. I initially wanted to find someone who was living in that community who was having doubts. And it became clear very quickly that I wasn't going to be able to get anyone who was actually still in the community to speak on tape. But I ultimately found my way to this really interesting weekly gathering that takes place in the city where people who are questioning, people who have left, come. So, and I met him there, and he made a very immediate impression. I checked in with him at least weekly, because things were changing so quickly for him in the different things that were going on in his life and the way that he was processing things. It was all shifting, and so I tried as best as I could to really keep my hand on the pulse of how he was doing.
I'm just curious. It's funny that he says he wants to be an actor, and one thing he has going for him is his look.
Yeah.
But does he plan on physically leaving that community and blending in more, or do you think that he'll continue to dress the way he used to dress and groom the way he used to groom so that he kind of remains in between worlds in a way?
I this was something we talked about a lot when I was doing the piece, and you know, my initial vision, actually my when I started doing it, was that the climax of the piece would
was
be
shaving
him. yeah and that seemed like a really logical climax/endpoint, because that's a really big step, you know, for a lot of these guys that I talked to that I met along the way. I mean, that's a big deal. So I was always sort of talking to him about that. And, you know, he has no plans to change. He is a very interesting sight these days, I have to say, because he wears like blue jeans and t-shirts and hoodies, but he still has a beard and payas. So he... And so he attracts attention, and honestly, he likes that. It's interesting. I was telling somebody about this the other day. These guys are sort of, and Loser certainly falls within this. They, on the one hand, they desperately want to blend in. They want to be, you know, just regular American guys. They really want to blend in. But at the same time, who they are and what makes them unique, and frankly, what's really interesting to people that they meet, is the fact that they were raised Hasidic. So there's really, even the people who change their appearance, there, I think there's this conflict between trying to erase your previous identity and recognizing that that is your identity and being open about it, in because people will also, you know, be drawn to you and want to know things about you for that reason. I also think that it's actually deeply offensive to people who he encounters who are still in the community, who feel like he's just, you know, how dare he be this secular guy and still look Hasidic? It's just, you know, I think they find it deeply offensive, I think. But
has he ever thought about stand-up?
Yes. He would love to do stand-up.
I just feel like he's born to be on the stand-up stage.
I'm gonna tell him you said that, and it will make him so happy.
Oh, good.
he would love to do stand-up. He actually, on his Facebook, his Facebook status posts are basically jokes. I mean, he's always sort of, that's what he's working out on there. He's basically writing jokes. He would love to do that. I think he actually, for all of his, you know, I guess it's not that unusual, for all of his charisma and his performativeness in a lot of situations, I think he's, you know, he has some stage fright. Because I've tried to encourage him to go to some open mic things, but I don't think he's ready for that. But yes, you hit the nail on the head. He would love to do that.
Oh, my God. He's got a whole world that he can demystify for people.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure the Hasidic community would be completely up in arms, and I'm sure he'd catch a ton of flack, but...
Oh, yeah. You know, he takes, you know, like a rebellious teenager, he kind of revels in that. You know, he has a lot of anger, and so he wouldn't mind that at all.
He'd get a lot of it, I'm sure. I mean,
yes.
let's just look at the response your story got.
Yeah.
I mean, it was he got feedback that was both super supportive and super complimentary, and you got some really vitriolic responses that said things like, I don't believe a word he's saying.
Yeah.
I know for a fact that his family supports him, and what a shame he is, like a scourge. So what did you and he make of all that?
It was not surprising. People in the ultra-Orthodox community obviously got wind of it. You know, they find this so deeply offensive. You know, he once said to me, to try to make me understand it, how his family feels about him, he was sort of like, imagine if you, you know, literally murdered your siblings or something, murdered your, you know, people in your family. Like, that's how they you know, I'm sure that's an exaggeration to an extent, but it's so heinous what he has done to people that... Oh, yes, they think he's horrible. I mean, they think the worst of him. They just think if you do that, it means you're a terrible person to a lot of people in that community. But he said an interesting thing. I actually don't think he said this in the comment that he posted on the tablet site, but he wrote this on his blog. He said, some of these comments make me remember why I left. And they make me feel good about my choice. Not that he was feeling bad about it, but, you know, his sense of the lack of open-mindedness and ability to rationally debate ideas that are outside the bounds of faith was a big problem for him. So I think it was hurtful. I mean, you know, he's a person, you know, he's a sensitive guy. And I think it would be hurtful to anyone. I think it was hard, but like I said, I think he also took some solace in the fact that it reminded him exactly why, in a lot of ways, why he left.
So his initial way out was this organization, Footsteps.
Yes.
How did he find out about it?
They, it's interesting. This is a whole other story, but the internet poses a really large problem for the Hasidic world, because it's something that they don't feel like they can completely keep out of people's homes, and they've never been, they have no problem with technology, Some people assume that they're like the Amish sometimes if they don't know, but they have no problem with technology at all. They're actually quite technologically sophisticated. But it's a Pandora's box. It's hard to limit. So I think he initially found out about this organization online and was able to connect with other people who had left and get information from people online. You know, a lot of things, his questioning started with looking up, you know, like reading like, you know, Richard Dawkins online, you know, things like that, you know, getting access to contrary viewpoints is not something that they are able to do within the community. So, but yeah, the internet was a gateway to a lot of those things.
Okay, just a couple more quick questions. Mm-hmm. One is, when you, as a producer, when you set about, you had a lot of material, and when you set about putting it together, what was your thinking about where to end this piece? Because there are a lot of unanswered questions.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm just wondering, were you thinking more about his process than sort of the nuts and bolts and his thinking when you were putting it together? Or what were you kind of thinking and trying for?
Yeah, I mean, I would have liked, you know, as I said before, to have a more sequence of events structure. And so there would be an event that felt more natural. Obviously, the event that ends the piece now, the tent that he's living in is not, you know, doesn't feel... doesn't tie a bow on it. And it's, yeah, it leaves you in this uncertain place. But it reached a point where this, you know, I felt like his life was just tumbling forward. And it was unclear when he was going to reach any kind of point that would serve as an ending for me. And if it would really be definitive. I mean, I think that still the story hasn't reached an ending, you know. This was something he and I talked about a lot, actually, because I was very open with him, you know, about what I was thinking about where the piece would end or trying to figure out where it ended. And I think we both sort of came to the conclusion then, and I think it's still true now, that there is no real end, you know. I mean, you know, obviously as storytellers, people like to want to have endings. But of course, life doesn't have those definitive endings. And it was really hard, I guess almost impossible in a way, to fabricate that kind of ending, to have something serve as that kind of ending. So in a way, ultimately, I felt like the uncertainty was honest and maybe the most fitting way. So I don't know if that answered your question, but oh yes, but I did, in the absence of some sort of defining sequence of events, or some defining event that would make it feel like an end. Yes, I structured it basically around his, you know, process, his psychological process of going through the stages of experiencing this. And I felt like when I recorded that tape, that comes at the very end of the piece where, you know, he said choice makes all the difference. I felt like that was a good place to end.
It's funny. I wonder if he's even ever, you know, because it's so funny. There are so many liberal Jewish communities that do welcome the kind of debate he's talking about, and so many liberal mm-hmm. Jewish communities who are basically atheistic in a way.
Right, yeah.
I wonder if there might
and,
be...
And the religious Jews find this baffling.
Absolutely, I understand completely.
They're like, secular Jewish, what does that mean? That makes no sense.
Right. And I wonder if he would even remotely entertain dipping his toe into that world, or if it's just kind of like all or nothing, you know? Because there's so many stripes.
Yes, yes. You know, I think it's complicated. I mean, he does, you know, sometimes he'll go to like Hasidic weddings, like people he's still in touch with. And, you know, that's one place where his appearance, I mean, he's able to move between both worlds to an extent, you know, and that's a pretty, you know, unique ability that he has. I think that while he loves the traditions and, you know, he loves to sing the songs and he loves a lot of the music, it's very conflicted, because I think, unfortunately, the well is so poisoned for him. You know, the Jewish world to him, I don't think he can separate out those things, you know? It's such a charged thing. So maybe at some point, I mean, I know there's aspects of the Jewish culture he loves, but there's such ambivalence and there's so many conflicting emotions surrounding just things Jewish. You know, at one point he just wanted to move to Texas and just be away from anything that was Jewish. You know, he really wanted to.
That would be a good place to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Who knows? Yeah. Initially he would tell me that he knew he wanted to ultimately have, when he remarried, you know, he wanted to have a Jewish wife. He wanted his kids to be Jewish, but he doesn't talk about that anymore. And he's been dating a Gentile for about a year now. So,
the plot
thickens. Not the woman in the piece, but.
For the common listener, I'm wondering if you can put his name in some context, because it's so unusual and it is so loaded. If you interpret it as an English word, of course it's spelled L-U-Z-E-R. And we know it's a biblical name, but I don't really know the history of it. And has he ever thought of just, you know, going by Lou in the secular world?
In the same way that, he keeps his appearance. He likes, it gets him attention. It makes an immediate impression. And he likes that. Actually, when I first met him, one of the things that, you know, so this happens all the time with him, of course, people meet him and they think they've misunderstood what he's, you know, like loser, his name can't possibly be loser. So I met him and he introduced himself as loser. And I was like, excuse me, pardon me, what did you say? You know, we went through that a couple times and then he just pulled out his driver's license and showed it to me. He's very comfortable with who he is, you know. He's very comfortable with who he is. I think I would definitely personally be tempted to change my name if it was loser. He's very comfortable with it. And like I said, it obviously makes an impression. It makes him memorable. I mean, he's memorable in all sorts of ways, but it's part of that. And he's aware of that and he enjoys that.
So last question. The other piece in the show is about a person who's in the process of transitioning from one gender to another. How do you think that Loser would feel about sharing the stage with that story? And as a producer, how do you feel about it?
Oh, I definitely think I've heard that story. And there's, you know, I know Sarah, I haven't talked extensively with her about it, but I feel like we were going for the same, you know, we were trying to capture the same sort of human drama, you know? I think it makes total sense that you would put them together on the same show. You know, of course it's about struggling with identity and trying to forge a new identity that you somehow think is more real than what you've been living. I mean, it's just a tremendous number of parallels, definitely. And I mean, I think I could have, my desire for the story, for this kind of story, could have easily led me to that story. You know, it wasn't specific to this subject. It was specific to that kind of human drama. So, I don't know. I'd like to think that Loser would find it, you know, feel a kinship with that level of bravery to defy convention and, you know, society, you know, the community or societal norms that you live in order to pursue what you feel to be right. I think he would feel that way. You know, he's very much, because of what he's been through, he's I think it's made him ultra liberal. You know, I think he feels like people should have freedom to express themselves and be whoever they are and do whatever they want to do, which is obviously not what he learned growing up. So I think he would get that. I think he would. I think he would relate to it. I do. Yeah.